I can say good afternoon now. For those that may not have good eyesight, I'm not Elaine Grace. Elaine's been detained somewhere else. I'm John McClanahan from the Institute. This is a very important topic, and we're lucky to have two really significant contributors to superannuation issues to address the topic. Paul Chalouse, a principal with Mercer. His role includes monitoring legislative developments and advising trustees and employers on superannuation and related matters. He's a long-standing and highly valued member of the Actuaries Institute Superannuation Practice Committee, and he chairs the SPC Legislation Committee of that group, so it's a really busy task. He's been a significant contributor to submissions to government on behalf of Mercer and on behalf of the Institute, and he's been heavily involved even in the last week on a submission on robo-advice that's being put out. He'll be followed by Esther Conway, also a principal of Mercer. Esther's a member of Mercer's public sector superannuation team. She's had 20 years' experience providing advice on both private and public sector superannuation issues. For her sins, she's just joined the Institute Superannuation Projections and Disclosure Subcommittee, which is probably the hardest working subcommittee, I think, in the Institute. So she'll be very busy for the next period of time. Anyway, to begin, I'll ask Paul to join us.
Thanks very much, John, and good afternoon, everyone. I'll make an apology on behalf of Andrew Boll. Andrew chairs the Super Practice Committee, and many of you would know him. Unfortunately, Andrew's travelling overseas at the moment, so he's handballed this one to us. On the Practice Committee, we thought about the topics we should cover here at the forum. And we, well in advance of the budget, identified three potential topics. We were expecting some change to super in the budget, at least an announcement of the retirement income regulations review. We're also keen to have someone from the Super Projections and Disclosure Committee present, because as John mentioned, it's a very active committee and certainly over the last 12 months has been very active on a lot of quite a number of issues. And it'd be useful to give practitioners a bit more insight into some of the things that are being tackled and to seek your views about those. We're also going to deal with the Institute's submission on the objective for superannuation. In terms of the level of change that was announced in the budget this year, I think we'll probably focus on the first two of those topics. I'll talk a little bit about the super objective because there was a development there in the budget, but we'll focus probably on the first two presentations. So I'll present on the budget and then hand over to Esther on the super projections and disclosure update. And if we have time, we'll go to the third topic. Now you'll see the fine print there, I should probably mention that any opinions about the budget that are expressed are mine and not necessarily those of the Super Practice Committee or the Institute or of Mercer. So bear that in mind. Given the time constraints, I'll also run through the budget changes pretty quickly. What we're looking for today is to give you a little bit of an overview of those, but also identify some of the issues that the Practice Committee needs to think about and particular areas where government may be looking for or needing some input from the Institute, and probably a particular focus on any impact on defined benefits. So this slide has a list of the changes announced in the budget. And of course, you'd all be aware that they're just proposals at this stage. The outcome is going to depend to some extent on the election and the makeup of the parliament after the election as to which of these will go through and in exactly what form. But it's certainly a comprehensive set of changes that were announced, and in fact far more comprehensive than we were expecting. 12 months ago we probably were expecting a set of changes like this when the tax white paper process was underway. But that seemed to stall, and from the rumours coming out of Canberra, it seemed that the degree of change to super sort of kept on narrowing down. So it was a bit surprising, and I think reassuring is probably not exactly the right word, but pleasing to see the amount of thought that's obviously gone into this package. It does address quite a number of the issues that were have been the subject of a lot of consultation over a period of time with super, and I think if this package were to be adopted, it would go some way to taking the pressure off super. We've had super under pressure with every budget in terms of the level of tax concessions that are viewed as being inappropriately extended to higher income earners, and this budget has, I guess, tried to address those. And in fact, has responded to a number of proposals that industry has put forward, from the Institute to ASFA to various other industry bodies. I'll also touch on the objective to superannuation, which hasn't received a lot of press, but the government says was important for the development of this package. And the last one too, the retirement income streams review. There was an announcement in the budget of what the response to that review was, so I'll touch on that as well. So moving on then, firstly to deal with the government's objective for superannuation. The background to this one was the FSI Financial System Inquiry recommended that an objective for superannuation be legislated. And the idea was this would form a guide and hopefully a constraint on the number of changes that were made to superannuation through budget cycle pressures, and to guide any changes that were made to give them a framework against which changes should be tested, and I guess hopefully mean that the changes that were adopted would be in line with the overall framework that the objective with the objective that was adopted. The government announced its response to the Financial System Inquiry recommendations in October last year, and accepted the recommendations to legislate an objective for superannuation. The next development was in March, when the government issued a consultation paper about the objective, and the Institute and a number of other bodies responded to that. It was a very short paper. It went for about four pages. Two and a half pages of that were excerpts effectively from the Financial System Inquiry. There was another few paragraphs that referred to the desire or that super shouldn't be for wealth accumulation or unlimited wealth accumulation and estate planning. And the government said that it was wanting to set the objective prior to the budget in order that any changes be adopted would be in line with that objective. So I'll leave it to you to judge whether that was a token consultation or not, given that submissions closed on the 6th of April and we had the budget 4 weeks later. Unsurprisingly, the government has adopted the FSI recommendation, which was to provide an income in retirement to substitute or supplement the age pension. Now, a lot of industry bodies, including the Institute, were critical of the level of focus on the age pension, and would have preferred that the objective encompassed the overall level of retirement income from both super and the age pension. And secondly, that some sort of reasonable target level of income in retirement be adopted. It's a bit hard to see how any particular level of tax concessions or super guarantee, for that matter, can be guided by an objective which doesn't have any target level of income to provide in retirement. However, a target level, I guess, would put a lot more constraints possibly on how the government might set policy. So it's probably unsurprising that the government has not, at this stage, wanted to put a target level on. The government has said that the FSI put forward quite a number of subsidiary objectives, maybe about a dozen subsidiary objectives that sat under the primary objective. And the government said that a number of subsidiary objectives will be developed and will accompany the explanatory material for the Act in which the objective will be set. So it's possible that we might see some level of guidance on adequacy or the level of the overall retirement incomes in those subsidiary objectives rather than in their primary objective. If I now move on to some of the tax measures. The first one is one that's captured a lot of media attention. It's the $500,000 lifetime non-concessional cap. And now this is also proposed to commence from budget night, I guess, if that's legislated. And what that means is effectively that non-concessional contributions which made up to budget night wouldn't be deemed to be excess, but any contributions made after that time would be counted or may be deemed to be excessive if the person had already accumulated more than $500,000 in in non-concessional contributions up to that time. Now, from an implementation viewpoint, what that does mean is that funds might need to report non-concessional contributions for the current year up to budget night and then the contributions from budget night after, so that they know which contributions were permitted, even if the person had already exceeded that $500,000 limit. The reason 1 July 2007 was chosen as the date from which concessional contributions would be counted for this purpose is because that's when the simpler super system started, the new tax system launched by Peter Costello out of the 2006 budget. And so non-concessional contributions from that time would have been reported to the ATO. So in theory, at least, the ATO has all the information that it needs to provide people with information on to what extent they've used up that non-concessional cap. And the tax office has indicated that that information will be made available on MyGov, or the intention is that be made available on MyGov, but they haven't indicated any timing on when that might happen. And we understand people ringing the ATO for information on this have had mixed responses. Some seem to have been able to find out a history of their contributions, and others have been told that it's not available. So we're not sure whether that depends on who you happen to get when you ring the helpline or whether the information is still being put together. One of the issues in terms of defined benefits that's been recognised is that for a person who has a defined benefit and is making post-tax member contributions towards that benefit, that if that person was no longer allowed to make those contributions, it would affect the funding requirements. So the announcements indicated that even if someone's exceeded that cap, they still would be able to make after-tax DB member contributions. However, they would be required to withdraw an equivalent amount from their accumulation account if that was the case. Now, I imagine there would be very few members that would be affected by this. Generally, people who have probably had enough money to put in $500,000 into super within the private sector would probably be contributing via sorry sacrifice. So I suspect this issue might be more relevant to the public sector where sorry sacrifice DB contributions might be allowed in some funds. But that's one issue to be addressed. Clearly, this limit creates a number of issues for large contributions, and overseas transfers, for example, would generally be, the large portion of them would generally be treated as a non-concessional contribution. So that's one of the areas where this limit will put a constraint on how much can be transferred from overseas funds, notwithstanding that there are other issues associated with transfers from the UK as well. Given the size of the audience, I'm happy to take comments as I go through. Are there any other issues that people have identified on lifetime non-concessional caps that we should be putting on our list to consider? You're welcome to raise those later if they occur to you. So I'll keep moving on. There's the $1.6 million pension transfer cap. So the amount that's allowed to be in a or transferred to a tax-free pension or tax-exempt pension will be limited to $1.6 million. And any amounts that are in excess of $1.6 million in a pension account on 1 July 2017, or at some time after that, it's anticipated they'll be identified by the tax office and the person will have the option to move that to a tax accumulation phase or to withdraw that from the super system. Alternatively, it sounds like they'll be allowed to pay 47% tax on that amount and maybe leave it in there. Not sure how many too many people would be very keen on doing that. Defined benefit pensions, the government has indicated, and really across the board it's trying to, I guess, extend the system to catch funded and unfunded DB pensions in the same way that account-based pensions are affected. So the government proposes to change the taxation of pensions which are in excess, or defined benefit pensions in excess of $100,000 a year. So the excess over $100,000 for an unfunded pension will no longer be eligible for a 10% offset. And for a pension over $100,000 a year from a funded or taxed source will be subject to tax on the on 50% of the excess over $100,000. The $1.6 million the government says will be indexed to CPI, so that's a concern that over time that's going to be eroded in terms of what it represents as a multiple of earnings. So that's certainly something we would be concerned about and would be suggesting that it should be at least linked to a WOTI rather than to CPI. There's an issue here with DB pensions as to how much they count. So if someone's got a DB pension of $80,000 and an account-based pension of $1 million, how do they go together against the $1.6 million limit? So we expect that there'll be a need for a factor to convert that DB pension to an amount that will count against the $1.6 million limit. And I guess if we're looking at $100,000 and $1.6 million, then 16 times seems to be consistent with that. So should it be a flat 16 times for every DB pension, or should it be something different depending on the age of the pension currently? So that's something we're happy to look for views on. A few uncertainties. do reversionary pensions count? So if I die and my wife gets a reversionary pension from me and also has her own pension, do you combine the two to compare against the $1.6 million limit or not? Unclear. Yes, so if the DB pensioner good point. Treatment of TBD pensions is unclear. The treatment of transfers, so there if you in an account-based pension in one fund, you're not happy with the investment management or some issue there and you want to move it to another fund, how is that treated? Clearly you need some sort of credit for that, so you don't, if you move an $800,000 pension twice, you haven't used up your $1.6 million limit. A number of other issues arise, for example, transferring the excess over $1.6 million back into a tax phase could give rise to a need to make capital gains tax provisions. How are funds going to deal with that? Okay. I don't think annuities were directly dealt with. It sort of makes sense to me. I'm thinking that maybe it would make sense to deal with them like DB pensions, but I don't know whether that's going to be the case or not, so it's certainly an issue to be clarified. My time's running short, so I'll keep moving quickly. The $25,000 concessional contribution limit. So that's a pretty significant reduction from where we're at now with 30 and 35K. DB grandfathering obviously become more valuable, so it might be harder to shift some of those people out of DB arrangements. The government is wanting to pull in unfunded and constitutionally protected plans into the mix here with the concessional limits. Currently there is practices whereby someone might be a member of an unfunded DB plan and outside they contribute, that doesn't count against your concessional contribution limit. Outside they're contributing $25,000 or $30,000 salary sacrifice to a taxed fund. So the government's trying to pull those in. How exactly they'll affect funds will probably depend exactly on their structure. So it's a bit unclear, for example, if you're untaxed constitutionally protected plans with accumulation contributions, how do they work? So... probably not. Not sure there, but I think they seem to be able to escape everything on a... Yeah, so if any people do deal with public sector plans, have a look at the impact and let us know if there's particular issues you identify with those. You're able to carry forward an unused cap for 5 years, beginning 2017-18, but only if your balance is less than $500,000. So we've got an issue there about how we work out balances of DB funds for this purposes. You might remember if you've probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, Labor had a policy of allowing a higher cap if your balance was $500,000 or under $500,000. That ended up being scrapped and replaced with a lower general limit. But I think a bit of work was done at that time and I guess we should be digging that out. Moving along to the next issue, the DIV 293 tax threshold is coming down to $250,000. This was pretty widely telegraphed before the budget. With defined benefits, we've got issues like the end benefit cap at the moment is calculated starting 1 July 2012. Will there be a different rule for those people who are caught now for the first time, or will the cap still be calculated even though they haven't been caught for the last 5, 6, 7 years. still lots of admin problems and issues with DB Division 293 that will need to be fixed up. So if you're particularly conscious of any issues there, please let us know. Tax exemption for earnings on transition to retirement pensions. Clearly, this will have a major impact on the attractiveness of these sort of options. Not a lot of DB issues that I'm aware of. I'm not sure at the moment whether anyone's offering DB transition to retirement pensions. So if you're aware of any of those funds, let us know as to whether that there might be issues that need to be addressed for DB pensions. All personal contributions are proposed to be deductible from 1 July 2017. Again, this will require a fair bit of admin compared with salary sacrifice arrangements. So from a fund viewpoint, I imagine funds will be keen to see members continue with salary sacrifice rather than this option. The government did identify that... I'm not sure the government did identify this one. There is a theoretical issue with DB contributions. Someone could claim a deduction and thereby the fund would have to pay tax on that DB contribution. How does it recoup that money from the member? So there are some potential issues there. Let us know if you think of any other ones. There are a number of other changes there. I won't run through them because I'm starting to eat into Esther's time, I think. Not many DB issues. If there's any issues you think the SPC should be raising, let us know. This was a tax strategy that mainly was adopted by TTR pensions and those... and mainly in self-managed funds because I don't think large funds were confident about the tax ruling. But essentially, there's an option under in the Tax Act to elect to treat a payment from a pension as a lump sum. So people who were under 60 were electing to do that, and the lump sum was under the tax-free threshold, so they effectively got tax-free payments under age 60. The retirement income streams review, just quickly. There was a paper released with the budget announced that there wouldn't be any change to minimum drawdowns. They won't allow additions to existing income streams. Still not too sure why that is. And maybe that's one we should be arguing more about. They are announcing, and I don't think this is the first time they've announced that deferred annuities will get tax exemption, but it's still going to happen. It's now going to happen from 1 July 2017. So they'll be extending tax exemption on earnings of deferred annuity-type products and group self-annuitisation products, which meet certain qualifying conditions, which are yet to be determined. There is a declining capital access schedule, so limiting commutation and death benefits in the paper that was released with the budget, but they haven't gone to the extent of recommending that schedule be adopted. So there still seems to be some uncertainty about exactly what the capital access schedule will be. And the other major piece of uncertainty with this is what the age pension assets test and income test treatment would be for a deferred annuity or a deferred pension type arrangement. So it's still over 12 months away, but it's a fairly short period of time to work out some of the outstanding issues, given that they've been looked at for a number of years already. So thank you, and I'll hand over to Esther.
Thanks, Paul. Can everyone hear me okay? I just here to give a recent report of the recent activity and ongoing activity of the Projections and Disclosure Subcommittee. And as with Paul's presentation, it's also an opportunity to get feedback from you as to the activities that the committee is doing, if there's other suggestions for activities we should be pursuing. This is a summary of the various submissions that the subcommittee has prepared since the start of 2015. I won't go through them in detail, but I'm just going to talk further about the product dashboards. You can see there's been a number of submissions and many more meetings on that topic. And I'll also talk a bit about the work we're doing in the retirement incomes projection space. So the product dashboards, as I mentioned, has been an area of significant activity. This is the short dashboard on the website, which the objective is to enable members to be able to compare different products. The main areas of concern we have is, firstly, the dashboard shows a net return, which, rather than being a net investment return, is a net return of all fees, including administration fees and advice fees. And as I've mentioned below, that net return, those to calculate the net return, it's all based on a single sample member with a $50,000 balance. So the concern is that for a member who has a balance other than $50,000, that net return may be completely different from the net return for that particular member. Another issue is the target return, which is shown on the dashboard, which is not necessarily consistent with the CIS investment objective. So you would expect that the target return, because it's being shown next to the net return, would be net of administration fees. There seems to be inconsistency in the way that's calculated and confusion about the relationship with CIS investment objectives. I mentioned the sample member. The other point is that on the dashboard, in respect of fees and charges, the member or the user of the dashboard sees one figure which represents all the investment fees, administration fees and any advice fees. So there's no transparency about how much the member is paying for the different components of those fees. And finally, the dashboard includes a risk measure, which is an indication of the degree of volatility of investments. The concern is that that is a short-term risk measure. So for a growth investment, it would be shown as high risk. But in fact, for a younger member with a long-term perspective, that may be a more appropriate investment or actually a less risky investment. And I'll talk to that in a moment. So aside from a number of submissions we've made to ASIC and Treasury raising these points, work that's currently in progress, we've developed an alternative layout with the committee's suggestions for an alternative design, which would address those concerns. We're continuing to engage with Treasury and the other stakeholders in this area, and we're working to develop a long-term risk measure for inclusion on the dashboard. With apologies for the layout, it looks much better on a single page, but this is a suggestion for an alternative dashboard. Just talking to the first side, you can see it includes the net investment return, so that would be net of investment fees only rather than net of administration fees as well. It's also compared to an investment return objective, which presumably would match the CIS investment objective. It includes both a short-term and a long-term investment risk measure, which hopefully would give the members some information about the trade-off between the short-term and the long-term risks. The fees and costs, importantly, is broken down in between administration and investment so that the member's able to see what they're paying for, and also it's shown for different balances so the member can choose the one that's going to suit their situation the best. And it also provides some information about past performance, both over the long term in the first box, that provides an indication of how consistently the fund has met its objective, and then in the second graphic it shows the year-by-year returns. Just on the long-term risk measure is one of the suggestions for inclusion. And this scenario would particularly welcome input of other actuaries. Our thoughts to date on the long-term risk measure, this is the objective, so it's to provide consumers with a long-term investment horizon, enable them to assess and compare the risk, really, of superannuation investment products. And this is our working definition. So it's the probability the average long-term net return will not exceed an inflation-based investment return benchmark. So, for example, the long-term risk measure may be the probability that a fund won't meet this specified objective. At this stage, we've used a suggestion of CPI plus 4%, but we'd welcome feedback from those in the audience as to what they think about that particular measure. And I'll just talk a bit about retirement income projections. The committee has established and had approved by the Institute a couple of objectives for this section of the committee. In the short term, the objective is to establish actuaries as the experts in this field, and longer term, to look at the merits of establishing a legislative requirement for actuaries to certify retirement income projections or potentially others. The activities we're involved in to forward these objectives is, firstly, this was a paper prepared in relation to the change in the assets test, and there was an insight session to discuss that with actuaries, and that was to highlight the importance of having projections in this area, not just sort of looking at a simplistic analysis of the change. There was an insight session also on that. There was a paper presented yesterday at the financial here at this forum, and we're also in regular contact with ASIC regarding the class orders and updates to information notes, etc. And I think that's all from me. Did you want to? Cool. Is there any questions or comments, I guess, in relation to the work of the Projections and Disclosure Committee?
Could I ask anyone who was asking a question to go to that microphone and just state your name for the sessions being recorded? Thanks.
Mike Murphy, on your long-term projection, I'm comfortable the CPI plus 4 seems to make sense, but the presentation on that chart, if you could go back to there, where I was struggling with the visual on it, and just looking at where you got 4 in 20 and 5 in 20, it seems to indicate that long-term this product is riskier than it is short-term or something. And if you look closely, you can then see that what's different in the middle column, but just that particular presentation I think is dreadful.
Okay.
I haven't got a suggested improvement.
Okay. That's all right.
Like it's probably got 4 in 20 because it is 21-year bits, whereas the 20-year, the longer the return, it's meant to be a 20-year return, which isn't necessarily.
Yeah, it is. I think we acknowledge it's a difficult one to express.
I might just ask a quick question. The FSI has been a huge catalyst for change in the superannuation space. SIPA's objective of super, and now we've had the budget, and we've got an election campaign, which often throws up some policy proposals as well. What should the Institute be pursuing in terms of reform after this wave? What's the next big thing on the agenda?
Thanks, John. Well, I'm hoping the budget wave doesn't get much bigger. I think the big opportunity is innovative retirement income products, and I think that's where the Institute's been focusing its attention for a number of years. But there aren't easy solutions. The latest announcements in the budget about the outcome of the review of retirement income stream regulations, I think it's take us a step forward. We've got a time frame of 1 July 17 for under the government's proposals for extending the tax exemption on investment earnings to deferred style products, and I guess the challenge for the industry is to develop products that are going to be able to take advantage of that that exemption. Deferred annuities, I guess it's going to be interesting. We've had a number of sessions at the forum about, and in fact the session earlier today, the plenary session, we had Siddharth comment on the capital intensive cost of annuities, and I think deferred annuities are possibly even more capital intensive, given you don't get as much money, but you get the tail of the longevity risk. So I'll be interested in thoughts from the attendees here about whether deferred annuities are going to be the holy grail, and to what extent, or what sort of value they might offer. But it seems to me that there's an opportunity for other style of products to be developed that are not as capital intensive. And that's a challenge, I think, for actuaries to work with super funds to develop those sort of products. Open that perhaps to the audience for any further comments. I can, if you like, if we have time, I can quickly run through these last couple of slides. So I mentioned the government undertook consultation on the objective for superannuation. And the Institute's put forward a submission where we argued that the objective needed to take into account the whole of the person's income in retirement, so it needed to encompass the total retirement income, both from the age pensions and private resources. So the objective that we submitted was to supplement the age pension in order to provide a combined level of income that allows Australians to live a dignified retirement. Now, we didn't come to a landing on exactly what a dignified retirement meant, but we did make comments in this slide here that 65% of after-tax pre-retirement income might be a reasonable target for individuals. It was recognised that those who are on high levels of income shouldn't necessarily expect that the superannuation system would provide them with concessional treatment to replace 65% of their income. And I think with that background, it was suggested that, that maybe consideration could be given to a dollar level of target. And I guess we've had ASFA set their sort of comfortable target level or retirement income. So that's possibly a starting point. But in our submission, we suggested that some more research and consultation would be appropriate to try and get some consensus on a reasonable target level to be adopted as part of the retirement income objectives. In terms of sustainability, we suggested that was also an important consideration, and suggested that some sort of target level of cost via GDP was a reasonable thing to consider. In terms of equity and fairness, you'll see that this list is not that far from a number of the government's measures adopted in the budget. So retention of the low-income earners super contribution, well, they didn't do that, but they did it effectively in terms of the proposed tax offset. They brought Division 293 down to $250,000. $180,000 plus $25,000 in concessional contributions is $205,000 plus some fringe benefits. You're probably not that much different from $250,000, probably a bit lower. But that, I think, given Labor had suggested $250,000, the coalition decided they would use that rather than extending further. Lifetime contributions caps. They've gone for a lifetime contributions cap on non-concessional contributions. And they've gone for a combination of annual caps with a roll-forward arrangement for balances under $500,000. So a move in that sort of direction, even with concessional caps. And the limit on tax-free retirement incomes, so $2.5 million was the number put forward by a number of bodies, including the Institute. $1.6 million is a bit less than that. There's obviously room to argue about, you know, what the number should be. But these are the sorts of measures that I think the Institute and other bodies thought were really needed to take the heat out of the pressure on the super system that it was unduly favouring high-income earners. So with these sort of measures in place, we would hope they could lead to some sort of stable period for super where we don't see it continually under pressure in terms of looking for budget savings and closing of loopholes. I think I'll stop it there.
Well, that was a really difficult job to step in for Andrew and cover, you know, such an extensive field of issues that are complex and still evolving. The fact that we didn't have many questions probably points to the fact that you've already answered what most people are thinking. So thanks for today, and also the great work that you're doing on the Super Committee and the SPD as well. It's really important work, so I'll just ask the audience to show their appreciation.